KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and 106.7 in St. Paul. This is Health Notes from the Hearts of a Natural Woman.
This program will inspire you, inform you, feed you healthy recipes, engage you politically, enlighten you spiritually. Help me name it. I'm no longer doubtful of what I'm living for. And if I make you happy, I don't need to do more. Cause you make me feel. You make me feel. This evening, we're talking with Dr. Rick Hansen. We're talking about his book, Buddha's Brain, the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom. Good evening, Rick.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. How did Buddha's Brain come about?
At the essence of it, I wanted to write a book that used the latest brain science, which has just been exploding with information in the last 10, 20 years. In fact, scientists estimate that the knowledge about the brain has roughly doubled since just 1990, you know, just the last 20 years. So I wanted to write a book that tapped that explosion of information, but informed it with the wisdom of the world's great contemplative traditions, notably the one I'm most trained in, which is Buddhism, and which is the one also that's had the most crossover with Western science, because at bottom, they share common values in terms of taking nothing on faith alone and empiricism, in other words, and also pragmatism. They're very practical disciplines. I think the great Dharma question of all time is Dr. Phil's. How's that working for you? Right? You know what I mean? So anyway, so that's both science and Buddhism right there. So I wanted to tap those wisdom streams, you know, both modern brain science and Western psychology, as well as these ancient contemplative traditions, and then mine their intersection for practical tools, because that's what the book's all about. It's about practical methods, practical ways regular people with no background in mindfulness or brain science or anything esoteric at all can, in the middle of busy lives, in traffic, raising kids, when the oatmeal starts to fly, dealing with other people at work, dealing with their own issues from childhood or their last job or last marriage or, you know, last week at work, you know, dealing with fear and fear-mongering in the evening news and all the rest of that, can deal with all that in a skillful way, whereby they can gradually use their mind alone, just their thoughts and feelings, their mind alone to change their own brain over time, which will then change their own mind for the better, so that they're more resilient, more confident, less depressed, less anxious, less angry, more patient, more loving, less lonely, less separated. And if it's of interest to them, and I've got some chapters on this, they can deepen their own spiritual practice. It's kind of like, for me, an operating manual of your own brain. You know, nobody gave you an operating manual for your own brain. It's not like, you know, when you get a telephone or a radio or TV or whatever, you know, there's an operating manual for a computer. Nobody gives you one for your own brain, but we need one. And toolbox, full of tools that are practical, based in science, that you can use in everyday life.
You say in your book that when we change our mind, that our brain changes. I don't know that most of us really understand the distinction between the brain and the mind. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. Great question. Brain is hardware, right? Mind is software. Or to put it a little differently, brain or nervous system broadly is matter, okay? Whereas mind is information, and information is immaterial. And that may sound kind of what? But if you think about it, we live with examples of this all around the place. For example, if a person is just reading something, the marks on the page, you know, black and white, let's say, are made of matter. The shapes are material. But the information that's being conveyed by those marks on the page is immaterial. In other words, the meaning of the words that people are reading. Or right now, sound waves, basically, as people listen to this show, are made of matter, you know, as air, which is a gas, gets patterned by sound moving through it. But the meaning of those sound waves, you know, so that people who speak English, at least, because that's the language we're using here, can understand, can make sense of those patternings of sound waves, that meaning is immaterial. So in the same way, in our body, the material nervous system moves information around, kind of like the heart moves blood around, although, of course, blood is also material. And most of that information, which I broadly define as mind, is outside the field of awareness. What we're aware of at any moment in time, you know, the sights we see, the sounds we hear, and so forth, is just the tip of the iceberg. Now, to be sure, no one knows how we see the color red. No one knows how the movements of information through the nervous system translate into conscious experience. It's clear that they somehow do, because if you change the brain, you change the mind, for better or worse. You know, if you jack up the brain with some caffeine or you stimulate some region of the brain, the what a person experiences will change. You can also change the brain for the worse with intoxication or a stroke or Alzheimer's or some kind of injury or the long-term effects of trauma, for example. When the brain changes, the mind changes. There's this mapping, one-to-one mapping. It's kind of like the information in your hard drive has a one-to-one mapping to the materiality of your hard drive. Okay? In the same way, mind, information, meaning, which becomes things like thinking, feeling, sensations, sounds, and so forth, maps one-to-one to the nervous system. But it's a two-way street. That's the important difference. The meaning of the words we're using does not change the air it moves through. But in the nervous system, what's extraordinary, even perhaps miraculous about it, is that the information that flows through it, the thoughts we have, what we pay attention to, the emotions we have, the desires we have, what feels rewarding, what feels painful, the memories that come to mind, how we dwell on those memories or not, for better or worse, and so forth, all of that, that very real, very intimate, moment-to-moment experience of what is it like to be Rick or Kinshasa or Bob or Sue or whomever, all of that actually changes the brain as it moves through the brain. And it does so both temporarily and in lasting ways. Temporarily, for example, if people become calmer, they'll get more activation of what are called alpha waves, which are reflections of different patterns of neural firings, of big coalitions of synapses and neurons across large swaths of neural real estate. Also temporarily, if people do something with their mind that draws on a particular region of the brain, for example, if they're paying attention, they're going to use what's called the anterior, which means frontal cingulate cortex, which is involved in the control of attention. Or if they're tuning into their body, you know, maybe through mindfulness of breathing or through yoga or Pilates or just getting into their elbows, you know, to work on their putting game in golf or whatever, then in those ways they're going to activate a part of the brain called the insula, which tracks the interior state of the body. What's also the case, though, and this is where it gets really interesting, is that how you, when you stimulate different regions of the brain because of specific mental activities, you also strengthen them. Because, in the famous saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, the fleeting flow of mental activity leaves lasting traces behind. For example, people who routinely engage in some kind of mindfulness practice, you know, certainly if they do a regular meditation, and I bet this is also true for other forms of mindfulness practices, like really focused yoga or Pilates or other Tai Chi or Qigong or other body practices, even just walking very mindfully, you know, 10, 20, 30 minutes a day, with or without the family dog and all the rest of that, what that will actually do is thicken the neural tissues in two critical parts of your brain, the two I just mentioned. It'll thicken the anterior cingulate cortex, so there are more synapses there and more blood flow because it's busier. And then also the insula will thicken through continual use. It's literally like building a muscle, except it's not muscle tissue, it's neural tissue. But if you use it, it gets stronger, right? And studies have shown that people who, for example, have a long-term mindfulness practice do indeed have thicker parts of the brain in the region of the anterior cingulate cortex because they're paying attention very deliberately, and in the region of the brain that's the insula because they're tuning into their bodies and tuning into their deep feelings, which also wonderfully makes them more able to be empathic for other people. And these changes in the brain are not just in esoteric things like mindfulness and meditation. They show up in all kinds of ways because, you know, if we learn anything new, the brain has got to change. Even London taxicab drivers, you've got to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets in London before they get their cabbie license, right? At the end of their training, a part of their brain called the hippocampus, which does visual spatial memory, is measurably thicker because it, too, has grown through use in terms of forming new connections between neurons. The takeaway here is that in the traditional saying, the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon, where more to update data in, you know, neuropsychological terms, you know, the brain takes the shape of what the mind rests upon. In other words, if you routinely dwell on regrets, resentments, your self-criticism, feeling let down by others, worry past the point that's productive and so forth, you will build out, unfortunately, the neural basis, the neural substrate of anxiety, depression, low self-worth, feelings of inadequacy, playing small, you know, pulling in your wings, ducking for cover and so forth. On the other hand, if you routinely pay attention to factually based good news about yourself and others, the world, the things you did get done, the good qualities that do exist inside your heart, and all the rest of that, if you dwell on, for example, things you feel grateful for or glad about, or you turn to resources like Kinshasa's show here and so forth, you will actually there stimulate and therefore strengthen the neural basis, the neural substrate of greater confidence, less depression, less anxiety, more happiness, more sense of worth, you know, and more capacities, more resilience, more capacity to deal with the stress of life itself.
We're talking with Dr. Rick Hansen this evening on Health Notes. His breakthrough book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. As you're talking, I just have so many questions. And you say that our brains are like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. Why is that?
My much shorter answers from this point forward with regard to this one is really simply, as our ancestors evolved, I mean, the nervous system has been around for about 600 million years. You know, what a long, strange trip it's been, right? And in those tough environments, many times a day, whether it's an earthworm or a crab or a lizard or a little rat-like great-grandparent living at the time of the dinosaurs 70 million years ago that's a mammal, or if it's a primate, which came in around 40 or 60 million years ago, or an early human toolmaker 2.5 million years ago who still had a brain about a third our size. The brain has tripled in volume in about the last 3 million years. Many times a day, those ancestors had to decide whether to approach a carrot or avoid a stick. In other words, get some reward like food or mating or shelter, or avoid some hazard like a predator or a big storm, a falling tree, or social aggression inside their primate group. All right, both are important. Sticks and carrots are both important. But if you miss a carrot today, you'll probably get a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So even though positive events tend to be more frequent for most people, and even in evolution, positive events tended to occur more frequently. On the other hand, negative events had more impact. So Mother Nature evolved us a brain that is paranoid, in a nutshell, that is very reactive to any sense of threat, that learns extremely quickly from pain. Because if you think about it, you probably will have multiple chances to learn in the wild as we evolved in the Serengeti, let's say, how to go get a carrot. But if you do manage to escape that stick that one time, wowie zowie, you better learn that lesson well, because you probably will not get a second chance to learn that lesson. Once burned, twice shy. So the brain has all kinds of systems that specifically look for bad news, and then when it sees bad news, does zero in on it with tunnel vision, kind of ignoring everything else, and then remember that bad news instantly, and including the reactions, like stress response reactions, fight or flight or freeze or appease reactions, getting upset, just getting irritated or sad or anxious activates the stress, the primeval stress response system in the body. So on the basis of that bad news or these reactions, they get stored. And then on the least whiff down the road in the future of anything that remotely resembles that bad news, whoop, you know, we're plugged in again. We're reactivated. Those associations get made in the neural nets in about half a second, and well, boom, that old bad news resurfaces. The brain just uses normal systems for registering positive experiences. In other words, it's like a sieve that catches instantly any bad news. But anything, but things that are positive, unless they're a $1 million moment, tend to go right through the sieve like water going through a sieve. That's why I think it's so important, half a dozen times a day or more, to take in the good. In other words, to change the brain so it's not like Velcro for negative experiences but Teflon for positive ones, but it's the opposite. Make your brain like Velcro for good news. In other words, in three steps, one, when a good fact occurs, let it become a good experience. And most of these are mild. You know, most of life in the minus 10 to plus 10 range of experiencing goes from about minus 2 to plus 2. If it's a plus 1 or plus 2 or woohoo, or even a plus 4 moment, take it in. Notice it and let that event, whether it's something you've accomplished or someone was nice to you or just notice something good in yourself or there's a, you know, nice fact about the world, condition in the world, like flowers are blooming, you're not dead yet, no bombs are going off in your pizza parlor, what have you. You know, when that happens, first step, let it move the needle. Let yourself feel it. Allow yourself to feel good. No one needs to know you're feeling good. You can do this in a business meeting. You can do it when you're dealing with the in-laws or whatever. You can do it inside your own mind. Second step, savor it. Stay with it for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row. As much as possible, neural structure gets built for three factors. When things are intense, when they fill the body, and when they last as long as possible. So the more you can make this positive experience rich and full and savor it and luscious, you know, enjoy it and, you know, sink into it, the better, all right? That's the second step. Savor it, relish it. And the third step is to sense and intend that it is sinking you, sinking into you. In other words, as you are sinking into it, it is sinking into you. And that will prime memory circuits to really register this positive experience. So it gradually gets woven into you. You know, any single time you do it will not change your life, but repeatedly, over the days and then weeks and then months and even years, you will be gradually weaving positive resources into the fabric of your brain and therefore yourself. And this is one of my favorite methods, and it's great with kids, by the way, particularly kids that are more at the either end of the temperamental spectrum, anxious or spirited, or kids that have issues. Had some tough times in life. Maybe there's a learning issue. Maybe they've just come from a really tough family situation. Maybe they're living in poverty. I mean, it's a tragedy that one in five kids in America is growing up, by the government's own estimates, below the poverty line. One in four in California, which is the state where I live. I mean, it's absolutely unthinkable. In any other, Western industrial democracy, to have this level of poverty altogether, let alone poverty for children. There you have it. For kids in general, but definitely kids who are dealing with challenges, it's really good to encourage them, even at night, just before they fall asleep, if they'll put up with a little psychobabble from mom or dad in their bedtime. Kids usually 3 to 13 or so will do that, to have them just take a few minutes to review the day and bring to mind things that are good news, right, and then take them in.
Support for KFAI comes from the Berlin Music Lounge, presenting Ella Grace, Friday, March 20th.
Composer, educator, producer, and trumpeter, Ella Grace unveils her debut album, Fabens.
This album release party will see Ella joined by her five-piece Mintet backing band to perform her contemporary jazz compositions.
Ella Grace is setting a new standard in jazz by adding her distinctive style and talent with this, her first album as a band leader.
More information about Ella Grace's debut album release party is available at BerlinMPLS.com.
My question is going to deviate a little bit away from the work that you did, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts were about the phenomena of the secret and the phenomena of law of attraction. People just ran to that work in droves. I'm just wondering, does your work confirm what they talked about in the secret?
I think what the secret talked about was the law of attraction at, you could say, two levels. And I want to distinguish between them, okay? So one level is the level of, I think, common sense, everyday reality, that any standard scientist or engineer or physicist would agree with. In other words, if you put your attention on your goals and you marshal an internal sense of intention that those goals materialize, whether it's a relationship or getting a better job or managing a child or an aging parent or pet or anyone else you care for is grappling with, or in a larger scale, social justice, if you zero in on those aims and then mobilize around them, you're more likely to produce results, right, than if you don't. And I think the more that those intentions are held both in words and in pictures, then you're activating more of the brain. If you also hold those intentions as if they've already come true, you are then doing all kinds of good things in terms of neural processing that will ground you in those intentions as if they've already happened, which will help it become increasingly real for you and therefore ever more powerful. I think all that is great. Then there's a second level that the secret got into, which was a more metaphysical level, in which somehow, in ways that are often mysterious, it can seem that setting our intentions can interact with the world in ways that go beyond the laws of physics in a standard textbook. And with regard to that level, I really can't speak much to it. My personal opinion, say this as Rick the guide, not Rick the scientist or Rick the scholar or Rick the therapist or Rick the Buddhist teacher, my personal opinion is that there really is a metaphysical dimension. Even if we rule out 99% of the examples people come up with of the way in which thought alone can manifest in some way in the world, I think there's just, from my personal opinion, just an irreducible residue of examples that are just, you cannot account for them through the ordinary laws of physics. And for me, as a empirical kind of guy, a Buddhist kind of guy, and a science kind of guy, that's evidence. And I think it's delusional to rule out that evidence just because you cannot yet account for it within, your scientific systems. But all that said, whatever is the case about the metaphysical level, I think that we've got all kinds of opportunities and, frankly, all kinds of work to do in the material plane, right in front of our nose. I mean, I see all kinds of people who have been, because of the bias of the brain toward negativity and toward fear, and then that being, exacerbated by their own temperament or life experiences and then modern culture and often political forces. I see a lot of people who overestimate the bad news in the world. They overestimate threats. They underestimate opportunities, good things that could be manifested at the material plane, And they underestimate resources. They don't recognize all the good qualities they have inside their heart and mind and all the support for them that really is factually present for them in their world. That alone, for me at least, gives me a lot to work with without needing to invest a ton in more metaphysical levels of intervention. I'm not speaking against the metaphysical levels of intervention. I think they matter, and I do practices, frankly. I try to be available for grace and so forth. But that said, you know, I think we've got a lot that we can do and a lot that we need to do down in a very practical, common sense level.
I was thinking about myself, and I noticed if I catch on to something negative and my mind starts to go, you know, it goes from one negative thought to another and worry or whatever, it kind of creates momentum. And once it's gotten started, it's a little difficult to get it to stop. I'm wondering if you could walk us through mindfulness technique that we could use during times when stress hits at any time.
That's great. Thank you. Well, to create a bit of a frame, I think there are three steps here. And the first step is to be with your own experience. To bear it, to experience it, to be mindful of it, to hold it in awareness, and so forth. The second step, though, is at the point that it's not productive any longer to just be with it, then I think it's time to let it go, you know, to release it, to help it release, to the best that one can. And one can't entirely always do that, you know. But that's where things like relaxation methods come in and talking back to negative thoughts or venting emotions or having inside, realizing that what's upsetting you has been turbocharged by your childhood, that has taken something that on the 0 to 10 scale of yuck, you know, bad events, has taken something that's really a 2 or a 3, really, and turbocharged it, amplified it because of childhood experiences and turned it into something that feels more like a 7 or an 8. Okay, those are all part of releasing, the second step. And then the third step is to replace whatever you've released with stuff that's more positive. In other words, step one is, you know, be aware of what's in the garden. Step two is, you know, pull the weeds, and step three is plant flowers. Okay. So if people, now let's bring that down to something real practical. If people are upset, I think the first thing is the first step. In other words, try to be aware of, wow, I'm upset. But to be aware of it with a sense of detachment and openness and spaciousness, so that, in effect, awareness is like the sky through which dark clouds of upset pass. With, you know, lightning and rain and thunder. But they come and they go. Clouds come and they go, but they never harm the sky. And the sky always dwarfs the clouds. So that's awareness. And then I think it's really helpful to bring self-compassion to oneself. There's a lot of research these days on self-compassion. It's a critical skill. It doesn't mean that you're wallowing in self-pity or woe is me, and so forth. It usually lasts only a few seconds or a dozen or two dozen seconds. But it's a feeling of, you know, just like I would wish that a dear friend not suffer, in the same way, I wish that I not suffer. We bring that kind of quality of self-compassion in. And then third, get on your own side. Be for yourself. You know, not against others, but for you. You know, so that your own experience matters and your own life matters and you're on your own side. You got your own back. It sounds obvious, but I cannot tell you the number of people I know who are on the side of everybody else but themselves. They will stand tall. They will speak truth to power. They will get up and make things happen when those they care about are threatened or harmed. But if they're being threatened or harmed, or their opportunities or their callings are not being fulfilled, they won't get up off the couch. You know, they won't get up off their tush. They won't get up off the ground, stand tall and do what they can, you know, for themselves. So that's the third thing I'm saying here, you know. Notice you're upset, self-compassion, get on your own side, and then take action. And that's where, again, it gets interesting. I think there's some specific things people can do that are good practices with regard to getting stressed or upset. One is to really activate the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system. This is the, quote-unquote, rest and digest wing. It's kind of calming and recharging. It's what recharges our batteries, distinct from or in contrast to the sympathetic nervous system, which is the stress response, fight or flight wing of the nervous system, which gets activated when we feel upset. it isn't just when, you know, a tiger is jumping out of the bushes that we light up this sympathetic nervous system. It's if we're frustrated at work, or we're in a wrangle with some family member, or we're trying to settle some sibling squabble between kids. You know, those two light up this ancient stress response system that releases all kinds of, you know, hormones into the bloodstream that are great short-term if you're trying to get away from a tiger, but they're really bad for long-term physical and mental health, especially for people who plan on living past their 35th birthday, which is when most of our great-grandparents were dead, you know, a million years ago. Ways to activate the parasympathetic nervous system to get this calming, soothing, recharging response. One great one is to do several long exhalations, like 3 to 10 long exhalations, because the parasympathetic nervous system handles exhaling. The heartbeat slows down a bit when we exhale, and it speeds up a little bit when we inhale, which is handled by the sympathetic nervous system. So 3 to 10 long exhalations, longer exhalations than inhalations, will very often take the needle of your stress meter back from a 6 or a 7 or an 8, and just right there, you know, in a minute or less, bring it down to a 3 or a 4 or even less. So long exhaling. Second, because the parasympathetic nervous system does rest and digest, relax your tongue. Digestion begins in the mouth, or touch your lips. You know, the parasympathetic nervous system, its fibers fill the mouth because that's the doorway to digestion, of course. So relaxing the tongue. And then third and last, I think bringing to mind the felt sense of being with others who care about you. Being, you know, whoever it is, people in your life today, or maybe people in life when you were growing up, a grandmother, a coach, perhaps a spiritual being who gives you a felt sense of being cared about. We are enormously social animals. We are the most social species on the planet by far. And very arguably, love, broadly defined, drove most of the evolution of the human brain, certainly over the last several million years as it tripled in volume. Most of that tripling of volume is devoted in one way or another to interpersonal capacities like language, planning with others, being able to plan for the future, plan for the past, empathy, altruism, emotional systems that are involved in attachment, bonding, and working things out with the quote-unquote village it takes to raise a child, and all the rest of that, you know, is very involved in the brain. So we need this felt sense of others to help us deal when we're stressed. So activating a felt sense of connection, of being cared for, cared about, that you matter, that you're seen as best you can, and staying strong, being on your own side in the face of the counter thoughts that often arise, like no one loves me, or I wish I was more loved, or I've been abandoned, or I've been, you know, really mistreated, all of which are likely to be true. Instead of getting sucked into that, which is not productive right now, bring attention back to those people, could be a pet, could be anyone, that make you feel seen and cared about. That will also help calm down the stress response.
What about self-love in our own regard? How does that fit with the research that you've done?
Self-love, people, again, they define that in different kinds of ways. The way I would be thinking about that myself is in terms of things like self-compassion or self-kindness. In other words, you are on your own side and you wish yourself well. That's what I mean by self-love. That can also be combined with a sense of warm-heartedness and tender good wishing. I have a friend who keeps a picture of herself as a little girl right in her wallet, right next to her driver's license. So whenever she has to show ID, she sees a picture of that sweet little innocent kid. You know, not perfect. No kid is perfect in some sense. You know, all kids are perfect in another sense, right? Not always a little angel, but still very endearing, very vulnerable, very sweet, and very deserving of care and concern. So I think those are good practices.
We're talking about Buddha's brain this evening on Health Notes. Dr. Rick Hansen. And Dr. Hansen, you say that calm is good, but equanimity is better. What is equanimity, and how do we cultivate it?
In the book, I make the distinction, which is also present in Buddhism, between calm, which is a state in which you're not having any reactions, basically, with equanimity, which is a state where you're not reacting to your own reactions. In other words, as we go through life, and as the Buddha taught, and as is very embedded in the view of Western psychology, there is the what Western psychology calls the hedonic tone of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral to all experiences. In Buddhism, it's called, and you may know this yourself already, it's called the feeling tone. By feeling doesn't mean emotion. It means feeling as in, you know, does it feel good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Anyway, what the brain does is it's constantly tracking pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then if it's pleasant, it reacts to it. Aha, a carrot, or a signal of a carrot. Let's go have more of the pleasant, you know? So if one glass of wine feels good, let's have more, right? Or if kicking the dog feels good, let's kick it twice, or something like that. You know, that tends to be what the brain does. On the other hand, if it notes it as unpleasant, then the brain goes, oh, we want that unpleasant to stop. So then it gets activated in terms of fighting, fleeing, freezing, or appeasing, or through other methods, you know, to get the unpleasant to stop. One example here of the whole idea of the negativity bias that we talked about earlier is that unpleasant feeling tones, unpleasant hedonic tones, tend to be much more powerful. They produce a lot more brain activity on the whole than do equivalent pleasant feeling tones. That's one more example of the negativity bias. With equanimity, we install a kind of shock absorber. Instead of being manipulated, in a sense, or activated by pleasant or unpleasant, we hold the pleasant or unpleasant in a kind of space of mindfulness so that we go, oh, this is unpleasant, or oh, this is pleasant. But we're not necessarily activated into hatred or greed, as the Buddha put it in traditional terms that are very far-reaching, very broad in what they actually mean. But in other words, just because something feels good doesn't mean I should start wanting it. And it certainly doesn't mean that I need to start pursuing it. And it really, really, really doesn't mean that I need to get frustrated or disappointed if I can't have it. In the same way, just because something is unpleasant, in other words, just because there's physical pain, or just because fear arises, or just because I'm getting angry right now based on something that happened, doesn't mean I should act on the basis of this unpleasantness. But in fact, I can observe it, and I can make a mature decision, a free decision, rather than being controlled like a robot or by like a puppet master, by the puppeteer strings of pleasant or unpleasant. I can make a free choice as to what is for the greater good of myself and others about what I'm going to do about this unpleasant thing. It doesn't mean rolling over, by the way. I think sometimes people think that mature practice, psychological and or spiritual, means just kind of gazing at your navel with a big stupid grin going, oh, well, whatever, global warming, whatever, 20% of the country kids below the poverty line, whatever, you know, people flying airplanes into skyscrapers in Manhattan, whatever. No, 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 no. Many of the people who've been most effective in speaking truth to power, I think here of people like Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Dalai Lama, and many others don't get who are unsung, you know, and frankly, the great many of the unsung heroes are female, you know, doing practices in the networks of family and life and neighborhoods and so forth. When those people speak truth to power and take action over time, they are empowered by equanimity. They are empowered by not getting drained and reactivated by moment-to-moment, you know, hedonic tones of pleasant or unpleasant, or the reactivation of the ancient stress response machinery based on those feeling tones of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And if you're going to sustain the marathon, social justice, and doing what we can to make this world a better place, it's so useful to learn some things about how your own brain works. So you can help that inner iguana, you know, that inner monkey, calm down a little bit and get so reactivated and, you know, go forward in life with clearer eyes. I mean, we need that to me across the dinner table or the lunchroom or the bedroom, right? We need that in our daily lives. And obviously, as well, we need it in the world writ large, whether it's the Middle East or Washington, D.C., or talking heads on Fox News or any Sunday talk show. That's where we need this kind of quality of taking charge of the caveman, cavewoman brain now in the 21st century, which is armed with nuclear weapons to help steer this planet away from the brink.
Support for KFAI comes from the Dakota, presenting Richard Bona. Monday, March 16th.
Composer, multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, and bassist Richard Bona connects African sensibilities to jazz, world, Afropop, and Latin musics.
He is always refining his sound based on his experiences performing around the world and from working with musicians like Herbie Hancock, Quincy Jones, Pat Metheny, Bobby McFerrin, Chick Corea, and others.
More information about Richard Bona live at the Dakota is available at dakotacooks.com.
In your book, you draw a lot on the traditions of world religions and of great spiritual masters. What can we learn from what great masters have done in the past? And is there a similarity between us and them?
I think about that at several levels. One, I think at the kind of everyday level of realizing that if you want to get good at anything, watch the people that are good at it and tune into them. Not just watch them with your eyes, but, you know, listen to them, tune into them. Kind of imagine what is going on in their body when they, whatever it is, do that thing, whether it's cooking or just being a nicer person, let alone someone who is really moving toward the upper reaches of human potential in terms of happiness, love, and wisdom, becoming increasingly transparent to, you know, the ultimate wholesome forces, you know, moving through the universe. So for me, you know, I want to learn about cooking. I want to watch, like, Top Chef, something crazy like that. My kids who are into, you know, swing dancing or whatever, they'll watch videos of people who are really good at it on YouTube. It makes sense. So if you want to get good at happiness, study the people, or you want to get good at love or wisdom, study the people who've made that their life's work. And that's where we bring our attention to people who are alive among us today, who've devoted their lives to this, many of whom are renunciates, not all of whom. Some of them are householders living in the world with, you know, mortgages and jobs and families. And also to listen to and read, think about the example of the lives of those people who are very, very developed, who've lived in previous times. So that's part one. And part two, I think the demonstration of the lives of these people, of what's possible for regular people to do, is enormously inspiring. Here, I do think the example of Siddhartha, who became the Buddha, is pretty wonderful. I don't think it's uniquely wonderful. You know, I think there are great, great teachings in other traditions. In this tradition, here's an ordinary man who did not claim any divine powers for himself, who through his own training of his mind gradually transformed his brain over time to the point of complete realization, which in Buddhism is operationalized as the greed, hatred, or delusion cannot take root and remain in the mind. You know, they might arise in a fleeting kind of way, perhaps, but they don't last. They are very quickly dissolved or liberated, if you will, in the metaphor from Tibetan Buddhism, like falling snowflakes hitting a hot stove. Anyway, at that point, you know, the Buddha turned around and he said, look, this freedom, this unconditional happiness, this ultimate peace, this way of wisdom of living in the world is available for everyone. And this was a radical thing in his time. He said it's available for women just as much as it's available for men. And it's available for untouchables, the lowest of the low in the social structure of India at the time, as much as it is for Brahmins. You know, the caste, the group that had the highest social standing. It, you know, it's available for anyone who will do the work. And that's where, you know, I was just in Minnesota actually a week or so ago teaching a course for therapists in a couple different places. So, and my roots are kind of very Midwestern, particularly on my father's side, so I have a lot of feeling for this. I think there's just something really wonderful about the idea that we got to earn it. We got to do the work. It's not going to be handed to it. It's not pie in the sky. You got to do the work. You know, I've been a therapist a long time, and it's made me more compassionate, and it's also made me tougher-minded. You got to do the work. But if you do the work, if you do tend to the causes over time, if you do water the fruit tree and take good care of it and fertilize it and have some patience, over time, it will bring good apples. You know, it will bring good fruit into your life. And I think that's the demonstration as well. That's the example as well of the great teachers throughout history. If they did it, we can do it too. Maybe we won't get to the very tip-top of Mount Everest in this life, you know? But here we are in the dusty plains or even the foothills, or even better, maybe in the mountain, the snowy mountains themselves, although we can still see the highest possible attainments are still there. The ultimate truths are yet to be known. But still, their example says, as they beckon toward us from the top of Mount Everest, hey, keep going. That's something a teacher of mine said to me a long time ago. Keep going. So that's what I would say to people right now. Keep going.
Is mindfulness primarily being present with our bodies?
Mindfulness is about using attention in a conscious and skillful way. That's all it is. It's morally neutral. For example, a cat is very mindful at the mouse hole, or a burglar is very mindful, moving through somebody's house. On the other hand, we can be mindful in more positive ways, right, of what is happening around us. And that includes being aware of dangers that are real, real tigers out there. Or it means being really attentive and present, showing up for other people who are talking to us. I find it quite amazing, actually, how quickly people stop listening to others, who matter to them, right? They'll pay all kinds of attention to a silly TV show, but my God, give 5 minutes straight of undivided attention to a friend, a partner, a family member, a coworker who's grappling with something important. Oh, that would be way too much, So that's an example of sustained and appropriate mindfulness that's externally directed. And then, of course, there is mindfulness that is internally directed, where we try to tune into our own inner world in a deeper way, sense beneath the surface. For example, if someone's getting angry, it's a great mindfulness practice to not act out on that anger. Let it be there. Don't shame yourself for being angry. Just don't act on the basis of it for, at least a little while. And then try to sense beneath the surface of that anger to perhaps softer, deeper, maybe even younger feelings like hurt or loss or fear or shame that are underneath the anger. The William James, the father of American psychology, over 100 years ago said that the education of attention would be an education par excellence, because attention is like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. Attention is at the heart of mindfulness, controlled attention. And, attention illuminates what it rests upon, but it also, like a vacuum cleaner, sucks it into the brain. Because neurons that fire together do wire together, especially for what is in the field of focal attention. So if we bring mindful attention firmly to something, particularly things that are useful, we are then, in wonderful ways that are, I think, very heartening and confidence-inspiring, we are sucking those resources into our own brain. Training attention is really important because, first of all, we evolved to have a very skittery monkey mind attention, constantly scanning for threats. I mean, just look at a bird pecking, grains on the ground or a squirrel, in a tree. They're constantly moving their head around, scanning for threats. All right, that's how we evolved to be attentive, which is to say not very. And then we live in a very ADD kind of culture where we're constantly bombarded with stimulation, so we get habituated to it, and we always want more stim, And then where our attention is constantly divided and skittered and sliced into tiny little pieces. So to stand up to those forces, to regain control over this spotlight and vacuum cleaner, which is probably the single most fundamental tool in your toolbox for getting good resources into your own brain and seeing through painful things so they can increasingly release. Well, that's where trainings like mindfulness training come in. Of whatever tradition you want to do, whether it's just really paying a lot of attention in your golf game or going fishing, or doing a prayerful practice or a meditative practice every day, or being extremely aware of what's going on in your body, which is where you brought it here, which is an incredibly important target of mindfulness, especially for people who are not upset by tuning into their bodies, because some people who've had traumatic experiences are. If you're taking the dog for a walk, or you're cooking, literally just cooking, or just putting a child to bed, or moving through tasks at work, try to bring a lot of mindful attention to that, maybe in bursts, like a minute at a time, and then longer, 5 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time, 20 minutes at a time, 40 minutes at a time. That will make you more mindful. Lots of studies have shown this. Attention is very trainable. And as I said at the very beginning of the show, you will be able increasingly, you will actually build out neural structures inside your own brain that are involved in mindful attention.
And it becomes a habit.
That's right. You become the habit of attention. That's right.
And so if I took all the principles that you've talked to us about this evening, it's really very simple. It's really about staying present and focusing on the good versus focusing on everything that we see. And as we stay present with ourselves, even the things that we don't like, we can be more effective in helping to find solutions for those things.
I appreciate how you're really bringing it down and summarizing. And to really bring it down, I think, be aware of what you're experiencing. Don't just be swept along by it. Two, really quickly muster self-compassion for things that are painful and unpleasant. And three, get on your own side. And then four, first things first, cool the fires. You know, put out the fire. Slow down, calm down your body, take some of those long exhalations, relax your tongue, bring to mind a felt sense of being with others who care about you and protect you and have your back and wish you the best. You know, cool the fires. And then really, really look for good news. Look for good facts. And then when you find them half a dozen times or more a day, let yourself feel those good facts so they become an experience. Then second, really savor them. Stay with them. Enjoy that experience for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row while, third step, sensing and intending that it sinks into you. I mean, there's a lot more we could say, right? But those right there, if people routinely practiced those, their life would quickly become better. And through ripple effects, would help make this world a better place.
Dr. Rick Hansen, Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Hansen.
It was a great pleasure to be here, and you have a wonderful energy, Kinshasa, as well as a wonderful voice.
Many of us look at life as work. We approach it and try to handle it like a job. We complain about it. We blame others when it's not working. We hold someone else responsible when it does not give us what we want. Some of us give up on life. We move from day to day with no plan, no goals, and ultimately no rewards. We fail to understand that if life is work, the better we do it, the better it will pay us. When we perform our tasks to the very best of our ability, we receive just rewards for what we do. When we are thorough in our work and put our best into it, we become better at it. When we become too good for where we are, we will be advanced to our rightful place. The things we must realize about life is it cannot be better until we are better. We cannot get more until we are more. The only thing that can stop our advancement in life is our not being ready to move. If life is work, run it like a multi-million dollar corporation and elect yourself chief executive officer. Affirmation. The better I am at life, the better it gets. That comes from the book Acts of Faith. Iyanla Vansant.
Have you been told coffee will stunt your growth? Or that you shouldn't drink too much coffee because it's bad for you? Well, there is good news for coffee lovers. There is more and more research that is suggesting coffee is actually very healthy for you, and that to some extent, the more the merrier. A number of research articles suggest that coffee may actually reduce your overall risk of all-cause mortality. Mortality is a state of being subject to death. That translates into, coffee may help you live longer. One study found that men who drank 2 to 3 cups of coffee daily actually had a 10% lower risk of mortality, and those who drank 4 to 5 cups a day had a 12% lower risk of mortality. The numbers were even higher for women. One study that followed over 400,000 people with a variety of ethnicities for 14 years found that the more coffee people drank, the lower the risk of mortality. Research has mounted as well that coffee consumption is associated with a lower risk of lung, prostate, breast, pancreatic, stomach, and colon cancer. One study looked at over 67,000 women who drank 4 or more cups of coffee per day. They had a 25% lower risk of uterine cancer than non-coffee drinkers. You've probably heard at one point that coffee is bad for your heart. The research, however, suggests that coffee actually protects your cardiovascular system. Research has shown that coffee reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease in men and women. What about blood pressure? Sure, it is true that coffee will temporarily increase your blood pressure. However, studies have shown that overall, coffee may actually improve the health of blood vessels. This, in effect, improves your vascular muscle tone. The short increase in blood pressure is due to the caffeine present in coffee. Once the caffeine is used up by your body, your blood pressure becomes normal. Coffee consumption overall can actually decrease blood pressure. Some other positive effects of coffee that have been researched is that coffee consumption raises your good cholesterol, lowers inflammation, reduces risk of metabolic syndromes, improves body composition by elevating fat burning, increases exercise performance, reduces muscle soreness, and increases reaction time and motivation. Many of the positive effects of coffee come from the fact that coffee contains a lot of antioxidants and cholinergic acid, which provides protection for our body. Similar effects have been shown with decaffeinated coffee as well. This brings up the fact that not all coffee is created equal. In general, you want fresh, high-quality coffee that is preferably organic. Also, to be clear, coffee is not a cure-all. It is also very important to note that the amounts used are actual cup sizes. This does not mean that subjects in the studies drank 4 to 5 venti-sized cups. They were drinking 4 to 5 measured cups a day. However, coffee is associated with an overall improved health status in many people. If you have questions about coffee consumption, it is important to consult with your trusted healthcare provider. People with certain medical conditions may need to watch their coffee consumption. But for healthy individuals, the science is piling up that you should be drinking up. This has been a Health Note by Dr. Jonathan Arnold of Arnold Chiropractic and Acupuncture.
This is Twin Cities Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and streaming and archived at kfai.org. Always a breath of fresh air.
I mean, this is not the kind of music that comes from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
No.
And you're living in Minneapolis, of all places.
Minneapolis, yeah. I will always live in Minneapolis.
You will always live here?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
It's so cold, it keeps the bad people out.
Thank you, Minneapolis. We love you.